This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. It's another edition of Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martoreno. Every week we're here, we talk about the disease of addiction, but most importantly, we talk about the road to recovery. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. We'll have more about them straight ahead. But first, we're going to bring you in the middle of this holiday weekend, something millions and millions of people in this country are, in fact, thankful for that you may not be aware of. Millions of people are thankful for their sobriety because that's how many of them manage to find their way through the disease of addiction. We have another story concerning the disease of addiction and the obstacles to recovery and then the ultimate success of it. With our guest who joins us from Florida, Louis DeMonaco is a treatment tech working for Retreat in their West Palm facility. We'll get more into what he's doing in the field of recovery as a professional. But first, we're going to get to meet Louis DeMonaco from the Bronx, who is now 15 years and counting sober. Louis, thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
All right. How are you today?
I'm terrific. Just before we went on the air, I explained to Louis that in spite of the fact he's from the Bronx and probably a fan of every New York sports team, and I'm a Philadelphian and am not, we agreed to get along for the purposes of this interview. Louis, thanks for joining us. So I always say this when I talk to people about their disease and their recovery, that all these stories are the same except they're different. So we are grateful for your time and we appreciate you sharing it with us. Tell us about Louis DeMonaco at the beginning. Born in the Bronx?
Born in the Bronx, yes, sir. I'm born in the Bronx. I'm 58 years old from an Italian family. And my family wasn't rich, wasn't poor. We had just enough. But during my time growing up there, I was not around my dad a whole lot. He always worked two jobs and even three jobs, so that we could actually support his family. And there were times in my life, I remember when I was really young, that I actually had to beg for a bicycle because we didn't have the money to get it. And as I was looking out the window, I saw so many kids riding the bikes that I really, felt bad that I didn't have one. And my family, with my mother and my grandmother, who I actually spent most of my time with, they were overprotective of me. They wouldn't let me do a whole lot of things. I am short in stature, right now I weigh like 170, but at that time when I was growing up, I was little. And a lot of the kids used to pick on me, and I would not fight back. I was afraid. And when I would come home, my mother used to yell at me. And when my father came home, he would slap me around and told me to stick up for yourself and, different things like that. And eventually I did stick up for myself. And then after that, no one ever bothered me.
Did you have brothers and sisters, Lou?
Yes, I have one sister. She's about 4 years younger than me.
Okay, so it was just you and her, so you were the oldest of the group.
Yes.
And as the first son, there is a lot of pressure on, standing up for yourself, act like a man. Was that a real point of contention between you and your father in particular?
Yeah, I believe it was because, the Italian kind of men don't cry, men are strong, men don't show their feelings. And to a point, that's still how I am today.
And so when you say that the kids stopped picking on you because you were the smallest guy in the neighborhood, what happened? Just one day you decided to defend yourself?
Yeah, I just lost it. One of the bullies had me down on the ground, and I kind of just, really got my mind kind of went crazy, and I just got up, and I actually fought back, and I actually beat him up. Mm-hmm. I guess that I always had it in me, but I was kind of timid and afraid.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you would mention that, because obviously it's a key moment in your life. Do you think it shaped you in any way? Was it important in the long term?
I'm not really sure, because now I'm kind of passive. I only would defend myself if necessary. But I think
so. You didn't become a battler after this, right?
No.
What about school and all that? How did you handle that?
I went to Catholic school. I was actually an altar boy and things like that. And I played some sports, played on basketball. I was kind of like the point guard there. And when I went to high school, I went to Catholic high school also.
So your folks who were, check to check, probably struggled even harder to put you through parochial school, correct? So education was important in your household?
Yes. They felt that that type of school was better and less problems than public school for me.
And was it?
And they did. They did actually have to pay. I forget how much it was. It was like $600 a month, I believe, back then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't easy. So education was stressed, right?
Yes.
For both you and your sister?
Yes.
Yeah.
She went also to parochial school.
Louis DeMonico is our guest. Louis grew up in the Bronx. He is a treatment tech now at Retreat. Premier Addiction Treatment Center is in Florida. He is 15 years sober, and he gets to that point not without a considerable amount of effort. And he has joined us today to talk about what he's doing now in the treatment field, but how he managed to arrive at sobriety. So you're also a veteran, correct?
Yes, sir.
Where did you go to college? Was there a college?
Yes, I went to Kingsborough Community College in Brooklyn, New York for biology.
And graduate degree?
No. I did not graduate in degree. What happened was, that was my passion, biology. But when I went there, I kind of fell in with the wrong crowd. And I actually just was a little bit short of an associate's degree, but that is where I started to sell some drugs and do more drugs and different things like that.
So the drug situation when you were a younger guy in high school or anything, how would you count? Was it experimental or non-existent, or what were you doing in high school?
No, it was. I was doing some, just try to keep up with everybody else in my Italian neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We were smoking pot, mm-hmm. drinking. We did a little bit of pills, and then this one particular guy in my neighborhood, he was the cocaine dealer, and he kind of introduced the whole neighborhood to freebase back in the 80s.
Oh, really? Oh, so you were of course. You say you're 58 years old, so you grew up smack dab in the middle of the crack epidemic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said
crack
that,
and the Quaaludes back then, right? And all those other things that were going around.
Louis, you've seen two. It's interesting. We'll pause here for a second. Just get your perspective on you. The crack. I didn't think I'd see anything worse than what crack was doing to this country in the 80s and 90s, and then the opioid epidemic struck, and it almost dwarfs what crack did. Is that your perspective?
I wholeheartedly believe so. The opioids are worse, but the crack and the freebase, it's not as bad if you're not doing it. But as soon as you do it, you end up going on a run. But with the opioids, once you get that physical withdrawal symptoms in you, mm-hmm. you just do it every day after day after day. And your whole number one focus is just how to get more. And a lot of people are willing to do whatever it took, and so was I.
And the other distinguishing feature, I would guess, is that the crack epidemic was not exclusively, but largely confined to urban areas, and wasn't thought of so much as a middle class suburban plague. That's certainly not the case with opioids. Lou, you what, flunked out of college and joined the service? Is that the situation?
Pretty much. I was going to college, and when I dropped out, I was hanging around doing nothing, and my father said, you're either going to work or you can't stay here. So I joined the Navy.
What was his reaction to you flunking out of college, and was it he couldn't have been happy, right?
No, I believe both him and my mother and grandparents were all disappointed. Because I know in my heart, and they did also, that I have the brain power to, to be something, a lawyer, a doctor, something to that effect.
How aware, looking back, were you that you were a disappointment in their eyes?
Well, they always believed that I was going to be successful and go to college and, do different things like that. My life, happened to take the wrong turn.
What was the military service like? What was that like?
I actually liked it. I joined the service in October 1st, 1978, and I was a sonar technician, which is a top secret job. It's kind of like looking at a video screen, a video game for submarines under the water.
Were you aboard a submarine?
No, I was aboard a surface ship. I actually was aboard the USS Albany, which was homeported in Gaeta, Italy, and it was the flagship of the Sixth Fleet. So we went to all of the great places in the Mediterranean.
Were you using at that point in your life?
Pretty much in the Navy. A lot of people drink and all that. That's when my drinking got worse. But when I got to Italy, I met some people, and that is where I actually started to buy large amounts of hashish, mm-hmm. hash from them, mm-hmm. for a very low price, and I used to sell them to the guys on the ship.
I'm curious about service people are not routinely drug tested, are they?
Now they are. Right when I got out of the Navy is when they actually started the drug testing. But while I was in the Navy, the ship that I was on was going to decommission and come back to the States. So I bought a kilo of hash, which is 2.2 pounds, and I mailed it to New York, and they intercepted the package on the ship, and they gave me an option. Either we open it here and you deal with them, or we send it through and you deal with the federal government. So I actually got busted in the Navy for trying to transport a large amount of hash.
Did that result in a dishonorable discharge?
It did not. I got an honorable discharge, but it resulted in 2 months extra duty, half my pay for 2 months, restricted to the ship, as well as losing a rank.
Our guest is Louis DeMonaco. Louis is a treatment tech working with Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers in Florida. We're going to find out exactly what that's all about straight ahead. He joins us, though, with a first-person account of years of struggling with substance abuse and how he managed now to remain sober for over 15 years. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you. We're here on Saturdays talking about the disease of addiction, and it's all sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. From their West Palm Beach facility, treatment tech Louis DeMonaco, as you'll be able to tell from Louis's voice, proud son of the Bronx, who now works in the field of treatment recovery, and he's 15 years sober, but not without having overcome a lot of obstacles and multiple trips to treatment. We're going to find out about that because it's one of the more fascinating aspects of recovery, how often people slip, relapse, but manage to get back in and get sober. That's certainly Louis's story. So, Lee, you took us through your sort of bio and career background. Tell us about your drug history. You say that in school, your use was no more unusual than your peers. When did that begin to change for you?
Probably when I was about 17, and I started to do some pills that they had back then, Tylenol, Seconals, Quaaludes, some uppers, and things like that. And then shortly afterwards, I was introduced to the freebase. And that is where my life actually started to go off the deep end.
Was there any history of substance abuse or alcoholism in your family?
No, not at all. Yeah. I'm kind of the black sheep.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for people who don't understand how this thing can descend on a family like yours, look, you painted a picture of a fairly typical, middle-class Italian-Americans in the Bronx, strict parents, protective, dad stern, but wants you to get ahead, and you turn to drugs. Have you ever stopped to wonder what that was all about? Why drugs attracted you or you to them?
What I really believe happened was where I lived, there was a lot of the younger guys, and they were kind of gangster wannabes. And once I was able to go out, without my mother being overprotective, I just started to hang out with these people, and they were not good influences. And little by little, we started to do, different drugs and different things. It was kind of more like peer pressure and different things like that.
So pill popping, marijuana, some drinking, no problem until you're introduced to crack cocaine.
Right.
And describe that the situation for us. Who, a fellow in the neighborhood shows you about freebasing. Do you remember what the first hit of crack cocaine was like?
Yeah, it was kind of like a rush that felt really good. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. But as far as feeling high, but then it's all about chasing it. You never get as high as that first hit, and it's about trying to sustain it and sustain it and sustain it. And you know, the money goes, my money, your money. I would steal, do whatever it took, you know, to get the drug. But this particular gentleman here that introduced everybody in the neighborhood, he was one of my friends. So there was many days where I didn't have to pay for anything, and he had large amounts. I also would have some people come down from Connecticut. That they would pay a lot of money, and I would get it for really cheap, and I would sell drugs to them on a daily basis, so I always had some.
You were selling to support your habit?
Correct.
Yeah. How soon after that first introduction to crack cocaine did you realize, or did you, that you were dependent upon it? Did you have that thought?
Yeah, because I always loved that feeling that I got from while I was smoking it. I just fell in love with it. And it just took me somewhere that I felt like I was on the top of the world.
Louis, for people who don't understand that that experience, how did you feel without the cocaine, without crack? Were you an unhappy person? How did you feel that you thought you needed something to get you out of that mood and into another mood?
I'm not sure if I was unhappy, but I wasn't 100% happy on, you know, which way my life was going. You know, like I said earlier, I believe that I was could have been, had some really great job, and, you know, my life could have went a different way. But as long as I wasn't doing the coke, I was okay, but I always thought about it. It was always in my mind.
At what point, how old were you when you were introduced to crack cocaine?
17.
Uh-huh. And at what point were you sort of defining your entire life around the drug, getting it, smoking it, selling it? How quickly did that happen?
Probably close to 20 years old.
So it took you a couple of years. Before that, it was just like, I like getting high, and that's what this is about.
Right.
What was going on around you? You say the neighborhood was rife with this drug. Were other people that you grew up with, guys you grew up with, also heavy into crack cocaine?
Some were and some weren't. And there was a few older guys that were like in the generation above me, you know, 8, 10 years older than me. They were actually doing heroin. I remember one evening I was in a house with them. And they were doing it in one of the bedrooms, and I walked in there, and I said, can I try that? And they told me, no, Louis, this is not for you.
Is that right? And you obviously you paid attention to them, or you didn't?
Yeah, paid attention for a while, but I ended up doing that anyway.
Oh, you did? On. You wound up using heroin?
Yes.
Heavily?
Yeah. Dilaudid, different pills that you could use IV.
So you were an IV drug user at that point?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Around what period of time, now? You say this process begins at 17, and where are you when you're shooting heroin?
Probably about 24, 25. When I came out of the Navy, I met this young lady, and we ended up having a baby, and that's when I had my own apartment. In the Italian section of the Bronx, another one called Arthur Avenue, and we started to get more into drugs. I actually was the one of the ones that started her doing hard drugs, and she actually died of a cocaine heroin overdose when my son was 9 months old.
Louis DeMonaco is our guest. Louis is 15 years and counting sober, and painting a picture of where this began, how he wound up with the disease of addiction. Welcome back, Recovery Radio. We're going to return with our guest, Louis DeMonaco, straight ahead. But first, I want to remind you that the whole thing is brought to you by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. This is, I guess, strictly speaking, the commercial but it's really not. We give you the phone number for Retreat, mindful that they are a world-class operation. Their reputation speaks for itself. You can do that investigating and find out just how well thought of Retreat is and the services and treatment they provide. But we give you the phone number as an informational tool and hope you never have to use it. If you have any questions or comments at all about the disease of addiction, anything concerning your treatment, what you're getting now, or you want to find out about Retreat, here's the number, 855-859-8808. Very important. People have to make decisions about treatment at the worst possible moments of their lives and under extraordinary pressure. So it's critical that you at least start to talk to the right people as soon as possible. And believe me, that's who Retreat is. 855-859-8808. From there, our West Palm Beach facility treatment tech, Lou DeMonaco, joins us with his story of substance abuse and his road to recovery. He's 15 years sober now. Louie caught up in the crack epidemic in New York in the 80s and subsequently used heroin as well. His story is harrowing, to say the least, and Louie's going to continue telling us. So Lou, you say you met a girl, had a baby. You introduced her to drugs. She dies of an overdose. Tell us about that. That had to be a traumatic event.
Yes. We were together for a while. We ended up having a baby, and I thought that having a baby was going to help me to change my life because now I have a lot of responsibilities, but it actually did not. And at one point in my life, I was in a program, and my dad came and visited me and told me that my son's mother had passed away over a drug overdose. The death certificate said chronic intravenous drug use, acute cocaine poisoning. She died from using heroin and cocaine, and she was actually passed away in somebody's apartment in the Bronx, and nobody wants anybody doing that in your home because then the police are going to come. So what they did was they picked her up and put her in the hallway. And she didn't have any ID. She was in the morgue for 40-something days as Jane Doe, and they finally found out who she was by her dental records. And I was kind of angry that that happened to her because a little bit before that, when I first got to this program that I was at, I had somebody find her that I know. They found her actually in a psych ward of Jacoby Hospital, and they got her to go to a program. She was there a couple of days and then left, and then this is what happened to her. And I felt so much guilt over that because I was the one that started her doing these heavy drugs.
How did you find out she had died and she was in the morgue for over a month?
My father told me.
He was actively looking for her.
Yeah, he was looking for her, as well as my sister. My sister was a big part of looking for her.
I'm assuming that the baby, being less 9 months old when this happened, was being raised by your father and mother.
Yes, what happened was eventually we weren't really together a little bit, and the baby was a hindrance to her getting high, so she just kind of dropped him off at my parents' house.
And that was okay with you.
Yeah, because, I was, after that program that I went to, I relapsed again. So now I'm out doing my thing. And, the baby certainly wasn't my priority when I was strung out on drugs.
Well, let me back up 1 second. So your wife's death was the event that got you into rehab for the first time?
No, I was there before.
And what were the circumstances that got you into that first rehab? Do you remember?
Yes. I was working for General Motors. I landed a really great job in Tarrytown, New York, and I ended up just completely spending all my money within 2 days. And I actually was making pretty good money working there. The only thing that I did that was good was as soon as I got paid, I went to the store and I bought my son some diapers, I bought him formula and different things like that, because the sense that I had was he can't provide for himself. So after he got his stuff, all the rest of the money went in the next day or two.
Were you raising him actively at the time, or is he still with your parents?
No, at one point we were raising him together. But it wasn't a great environment for him. But maybe at that point, I wasn't really 100% strung out in different things like that.
Well, the first trip to rehab, tell me about that. What happened there?
Went to rehab. I kind of learned a lot. I really struggled with the spirituality thing because, I was raised Catholic, but I'm kind of intelligent and I believed in science and evolution, so that kind of thing gave me a big struggle with the higher power thing. I came out of the rehab. It was a 30-day program in upstate New York, and I came out and I told my dad I got this. I learned a whole lot, and I'm going to stay clean. And unfortunately, I did not. And then I actually went back to this same program again. Both times were for the freebase, cocaine.
How long between the two stints?
Not too long. I don't quite remember, but it was definitely maybe 6 months or so.
When were your parents, when was your mom and dad, when were they first aware that you had a problem?
How old were you? When I started to not come home at night, and when I just got paid, and 3 days later, I'm asking them for money.
How old were you at that time?
Mid-20s, maybe, a little less.
They were aware of what was going on in the neighborhood, or were they aware of what was going on in the neighborhood? Were they aware that crack cocaine had invaded this Italian-American neighborhood in the Bronx?
I don't believe so, but my sister knew. My parents are just about 80 years old, both of them. They're still alive. And they really didn't know. I was pulling the wool over their eyes as far as that. They knew I was doing stuff, but they didn't actually know what it was. But my sister did know.
And she never had a problem with this?
No. She said that she smoked pot once or twice and did coke once, I believe she said. She didn't like it.
Second time in rehab, same thing, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. I told my dad, there were some things that I didn't learn, and I think I got it this time. But in my mind, I knew that I couldn't do the freebase anymore. So I decided that I'm going to do what we call substitution. I knew about the heroin. I've never done it before. And I also knew that if you do it over a long period of time, then you get physically addicted. So I just started to sniff it on the weekends. And you won't get physically addicted if you do that. But little by little, it progressed, and it became an everyday thing. And I was only snorting it.
Is there any way you could explain to someone listening that thought process? Because they just cannot believe that someone who is trying to break a habit of smoking crack cocaine would logically think snorting heroin made sense. Is that just something that this disease does to you?
Well, yes, it is. It is. A lot of people, in my experience since I've been working in this field, as well as myself, a lot of people substitute. And my logic was I knew the cocaine was definitely going to mess me up because I had big problems with it. But just by doing a little bit, just to feel that high, that buzz, was what I wanted. And like I said, it eventually got out of control. A lot of people in this field that are drug addicts and alcoholics, they try just to smoke pot, or the ones that are alcoholics, instead of drinking whiskey, they'll drink beer, hoping for different results. This is the insanity of the disease.
Yeah, it's interesting, a guy like you who, it sounded like you used to pride yourself you didn't think you were a dumb guy, you thought you were smarter than the average guy, maybe you had faith in reason, logic, science, and there you are rationalizing this behavior, and it makes sense to you.
Right. That's because the drugs and alcohol, they affect your brain. They affect what we call serotonin and dopamine and different chemicals in your brain. And your brain, if you are an addict, just craves that. It makes you make decisions that are completely irresponsible.
Well, as you know, because you've seen this thing from both the treatment side and the suffering side, that's the central thing people who don't understand this disease have trouble getting their minds around, because they look at somebody like you or anybody who would make these bad decisions and say they're either crazy or they're doing this on purpose.
And that's what my father thought. My father would just say, why can't you just stop? Because that older generation doesn't have a clue about the disease of addiction.
So you made, as according to my notes here, 11 trips in and out of rehab. Over how long a period of time did that occur?
Probably, let me see, 25 years maybe, something like that.
At what point were you just were you doing this to actually get clean or just to get people off your back or get some relief? 11 times people are going, wow, why would anybody keep going back?
Well, I actually wanted to get clean. I didn't want my life to continue, you know, the way it was. While I was in the treatment programs that I went to, I did the best that I can. And
You did. You gave it an honest effort.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I never was in trouble. I really listened. And when I came out of the program, this was the problem. Like I said, I had the problem with the higher power, the spirituality, but I had more of a problem following up on what I knew in my heart was the right thing to do. I did not go to meetings all the time. I did not get a sponsor. I did not work the steps, the 12 steps. And it was just a complete lack of effort on me. And also, a lot of the times I would get a few months clean, and then I would get complacent and think I was okay and think I didn't need these meetings. But you know what? The disease of addiction hits you every day. So this is why people with substance abuse have to go to a meeting or do something for their recovery on a daily basis, because your disease doesn't quit.
Louis DeMonaco is our guest. Louis is a treatment tech at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers in West Palm Beach, Florida. He's going to talk to us about his work now in the field. When we come back, Louis will share with us an absolutely stunning event that occurred regarding his son and his father, and bring us up to date on his now, again, a remarkable 15 years of sobriety. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I want to thank our guest, Louis DeMonaco. He joins us from West Palm Beach, Florida, where he is a treatment tech at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. He's shared with us an absolutely amazing story of years of substance abuse and now 15 years of sobriety and working in the treatment field. Louis had multiple trips to rehab, almost a dozen times in and out of rehab, and as I say, managed through all of that to get sober. He's an ordained minister. And it's like I said at the beginning, all these stories are the same, except they're different. And I know there's an event in your life that is remarkably different than what we've heard on this program, involving you, your substance abuse, your father, and your son. So could you tell us that story?
Yes. After my son's mother died of a cocaine heroin overdose, my son was 9 months old. And because of that event, my life took an even more turn for the worse, and pretty much it was the worst part of my addiction. I was living with my dad, and I had met this gentleman in Manhattan that used to sell black market babies to rich people. And he convinced me to sell him my son. So what happened was, one day I dressed up my son, I put him in the baby carriage, and I'm walking out of the house, and my dad said to me, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm taking my son for a walk." He says, "He's not your son. He's my son. You made him. I raise him." He says, "You're up to no good." He said, "You have never given him a bath. You have never dressed him. You never took him to the doctor. You never fed him. Now all of a sudden you want to take him out for a walk." He said, "You're up to no good. The only way that you're going to take this boy out is if you kill me first." And I did not do that. But that outside the window, I looked, and the guy was downstairs in a car waiting for me to give him the baby, and he was going to give me a whole bunch of money, thousands upon thousands of dollars.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, you know, that was a horrible thing. I don't think of there's nothing worse that I could have done. I don't think I ever would have been able to forgive myself for that. My son does not know that. My son now is 31 years old. He doesn't have to know that. And actually, my son is my best friend now.
Have you any doubt in your mind that had your father not stopped you, you sold your son?
I believe so. That was the worst part of my addiction, and it makes people do incredibly horrible things.
People, I'm telling you, as you know, Lou, you've told this story many, many times, and I know you tell it for the exact right reason, and you'll explain that in a second. But there are people listening who cannot believe any power on earth could get them to that point. What do you say to them?
I say that drugs and alcohol, have a strong hold on you, and nothing matters at all except how to get that drug. And people are willing to do whatever it is. You know, unfortunately, there's people that sell themselves, steal, rob, do all kinds of insane things.
How does someone get sober and forgive themselves for that? Do you still struggle with that, even though you were in the grip of a disease? Does that still weigh on you that you actually considered selling your infant son?
You know, it does occasionally. What happens is I'll see something, I'll hear a song, and it kind of brings me back to that, and especially over his mother's death. Her name was Johanna, and I would hear a song or something like that, and these thoughts would come back in my mind. But I've had therapy. In treatment, I've had therapy, which helped me. And one of the things that really helped me was this. Somebody told me, Louis, if you were in your right mind, would you do anything like that? And I would not. And neither would any other drug addict. So that was the only thing I had to stand on, knowing that as long as I stayed sober for the rest of my life, or as long as I could, that I was not going to be doing stuff like that. It wasn't me. I was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your son is now, as you say, 30 years old, and you have a great relationship with him, and he's never struggled with these issues?
No, my son is actually has got two master's degrees. He's a school teacher. I actually have two grandchildren, 1 5 and 1 2. And you know what? I lived to see them, which was a big point in my life. I thought I was going to die. Everybody that I knew wrote me off.
And finally, Lou, I know that you attribute your success in getting sober with finally reconciling yourself with this notion of a higher or greater power. Tell me about that.
The last program that I went to, I had moved down to Florida, and I had some clean time, about 8 or 9 months clean. And then what happened was I relapsed, and I met some bad people, and we ended up doing a big drug deal. And I went before the judge, and my lawyer said, Louis, you're going to prison for a long time. And the judge looked at me and said that he's never done this before, and he did not know why he's doing it, but he sentenced me to a program for 1 year instead of 20 years in prison. And he also offered me the 20 years if I didn't want to go to the program. So I took the program, and this particular type of program was actually a faith-based program. And the spirituality was one of the main things that I was missing. I just couldn't find something greater than me that could help me to stay clean. So that, in conjunction with the 12 steps, was what I needed. The second day that I got to this program, they handed me a Bible, which I had never read in my whole life. And I opened it up to the middle, and I looked down, and this is what I read. For I know the plans I have for you, says God, plans to give you a future and a hope. And when you come to me and pray, I will listen, and you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. When I heard that, when I read that scripture, it just hit me in the head like a sledgehammer. The next 2 days, I looked at the whole Bible, every page, to see if that was written on more than one page. It was nowhere else. And I said, you know what? I don't know who this God is, but I think he's telling me something.
It's a remarkable story, Lou. I know now you've been in the treatment field for how long?
10 years.
10 years helping other people. You have had your share of tough luck, but sounds like you got a couple of lucky breaks. That judge, certainly, that piece of scripture, and it's all resulted in not only your sobriety, but a son that you're proud of and grandchildren you can watch grow up. It's a very encouraging story. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
Louis DeMonaco, our guest. That's it for Recovery Radio this week. Enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend. I hope we've given you some things for you to consider as you give thanks. And look for us next Saturday. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.